Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline Donoghue and I have arthritis from the lack of arch support in my ballet flats. Joining me is part-time lover and a full-time friend, Rebecca Taylor, aka Self-Esteem.
Yes! Oh my god, that was so fucking funny already. The ballet flats.
My feet are, like, when they're on a floor, they're just completely, every bit of flesh is pressed to the floor. There's no arch. There's no...
No.
There's no lift, do you know what I mean? Just a flat slab of gammon is my feet because of ballet flats.
Evolution. That's how evolution works. They're going to do a Green Planet on it one day and it's just all these flat-footed women in their 30s. It was so bad. I used to wear a pair of slippers that were, like, had loads of, like, glitter on. Because you just, like, pushed your foot in and I just flapped about in them. And the strain on my shins, I got shin splints from the, like, agony of keeping them on my feet.
It's so weird that at the exact same time, the sort of, the exact same thing was happening in young female culture, which was, like, the introduction of, like, insane, like, heels and, like, you know, those kind of those irregular choice heels that came to the high street and just, like, suddenly 18-year-old girls were wearing, like, 6-inch stilettos that were covered in playing cards and also fucking ballet shoes and Converse. So it was like, it was one or the other. You were harming your feet permanently, whichever.
Irregular choice as well. Like, I thought that was the coolest thing I've ever seen. That and Tatty Divine. Like, and I couldn't afford either. And I was obsessed. Anyway, sorry, we're shooting right into it, but yes.
We're shooting right in. But today, Rebecca Taylor, we're talking about indie twee, which I've had an idea for this episode in my head ever since you and I first spoke for our Drag Race episode. And we talked about how the two of us went through a similar journey in the noughties, but we were on different sides of it because you were at the top of the chute feeding stuff in and I was in a HMV in Cork. Collecting it. So you were the top of the chain, I was the end of the chain.
Well, yes and no, but I felt very much at the bottom of the chain too. Like, weird. It's just, I think that whole era was just based on completely not trusting yourself or... like, I never had any confidence, you know what I mean? But that was the style.
That was the style at the time.
The whole point was to be like, oops, sorry, excuse me. Yeah, saying that I was cool is baffling to me because I was so, committed and obsessed with trying to be cool, but also very sure that I'd never succeeded.
Let's start from the very basics of what is twee, what is indie twee. I think people who are of our generation and grew up in the UK and Ireland will know instantly, but for people a bit older or for people internationally, they might need a bit more help. What are we talking about specifically?
It was just this era of music that I believe it trickled from America, I think. It was this anti-folk American thing. That's what everything about it came from, me seeing Bright Eyes and Tilly and the Wall and those sort of bands. And so sonically and visually, nothing was cooler than that for me. And so still even today, like when I'm going to the studio, I want to make the coolest thing I can think of. But that changes, like your taste changes. And that was the coolest thing I could think of. And that's what we emulated. And that's what I emulated in what I look like. But over here, it had a sort of... Like often, British versions of it aren't as cool. And it's actually really embarrassing. And we had and twee became this, a word you, like, pretty quickly I wanted to escape. I'm not really explaining this well. But yeah, ultimately, I have such a complicated relationship with it because once upon a time, nothing was cooler than a ukulele with a little red, with a little fabric R on it that I blue tacked on. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it was like absolutely deathly embarrassing. And why I think that happened was Slow Club, we sort of adapted early to this American version of it that we was like felt really cool. And then as soon as everyone in the UK was doing it, it was instantly humiliating to be a part of. I don't think I've explained that well though.
No, I think you did. But I think the thing is that there are some people for whom twee is as authentic a descriptor for a genre, and for not just a genre of music, but for like a clique, a lifestyle, an aesthetic that is legitimate. And for some people, it is just the first insulting thing they heard the music they either made or liked be called by a really bullshit music magazine and a really bullshit man who was working there. Like, I was revisiting some coverage from, I think, 2008 of early Los Campesinos tracks. And that guy who worked for The Quietus, who died a few years ago, but his whole thing was making horrible statements about quite harmless bands. He just... literally, in a 1,000-word essay about Los Campesinos, the word pedo came up 6 times. Like, this
guy, like deserved. No, I'm joking.
Deserved.
One of my favorite ever bands, by the way. Still.
Oh yeah, yeah. An incredible band, a wonderful band, and we're definitely right there along with you guys as being hailed as being the British version of an American thing, and so therefore already being called something copycat and derivative, even though those inspirations were very valid. And also because they have this specific point of view and this specific aesthetic, and I'm including you and Slow Club and Lost Camp in this, this thing of an element of naivety and whimsy that because the music was being made by genuinely young people was just going to be there anyway.
Yeah.
And also an openness and a lack of meanness and a lack of cruelty that kind of hardened music journos who loved rock music and punk music saw as inherent weakness.
Yeah, God.
And preyed on it.
You're a genius. That's exactly it. It's so funny because I just lived it so hard, and my obviously my relationship to making music and having an aesthetic and all that has been just been ages and so long and so governed by other people it's hard for me to objectively look at twee. But even then when you were saying it, I was like, of course we were making this sort of sweet stuff because we were 18. And but the thing that makes no sense to me is like, how come it was sort of genius that somehow for a brief moment in time being kind, sweet, whimsical was cool. and I'm you know, the hardened journalist now, I guess, I would never be mean, but I can see why it was annoying to a more jaded lived experience of someone a bit older. But yeah, I just really haven't got anything more. I wish I had a more sort of scholarly response to like why it felt chic as fuck, but it did, really briefly. And like, I have never felt more powerful than wearing like a vintage dress. I had this fucking plastic piano brooch that I put on a headband, and I would put that on my head. So this is like floating piano in my hair. And I felt like, I felt like, you know, Julia Fox feels today in it. I felt legitimately high-end creative.
But that's the thing. I mean, I don't think there's anything shameful about that. And I think I don't know if you sort of keep it, because I write in YA, I sort of keep half an eye on youth trends just to see what I can pilch to
anything I can use with it. Oh yeah.
Yeah. But dark academia is a big thing now. I don't know if you've heard that before. It's this whole sort of TikTok aesthetic that's very much linked to The Secret History and those kind of campusy novels where somebody gets murdered, where it's all about tweeds and a beret and drinking coffee. And it's kind of, it's their twee.
It's back. Yeah.
It's back. It's back. And it's sort of beautiful to me because I think everyone has this period where you maybe when you were in your teens proper, like 15, 16, you would gravitate, certainly our generation, towards emo and punk and a bit more black sky thinking. And then you kind of emerge going to uni and the world feels sort of open and you're sort of experimenting with adult dressing, which is why so many of us ended up in these genuinely frumpy dresses.
So funny. I was obsessed. It was a mix of like, I had this friend who was 4 years older than me and she was like really into Carrie Bradshaw and really into vintage shopping and stuff. She lived in a flat in Sheffield. Like she was 18 and had a flat. That was amazing, you know, and drove. And
Unbelievably cool.
Like she blew my mind. And we were both in this amateur dramatics musical and she was the lead. And she, for rehearsal one day, turned up in lime green stiletto, vintage lime green stilettos and clacked about in them. And I was just like, I can see it right now. And I was obsessed and I like made her be my friend. And then we used to drive to the Corn Exchange in Leeds, go rifling through these stinking dresses and come out with hundreds of them. My mum would be like, ugh. But yeah, why was that so cool? I wonder what the true origin is.
I think from a style point of view, and it's funny because it's like, as I said, yes, it's the music, but it's also it's everything else. It's the style, it's the behavior, it's the vernacular of the whole thing. I find it so interesting because I think around that time period, the sort of the raunch era of like massly available sex tapes. Like, I mean, I had brothers, so I saw sex tapes very early in like Paris Hilton sex tape and all that kind of stuff. That felt quite scary. Like it was this weird era where like it wasn't that uncommon for like a 17-year-old to have tried anal, and because like that was the level of you know whatever the how rattled we were as a culture because we got so much sex culture all at once and like the whole the party girl thing, Lindsay Lohan, all these examples of the kind of women that you couldn't be. And so there was something that felt very scary about that culture and therefore taking refuge in something that was quite conservative but also felt radical in its own way because there was a spirit of being eclectic about it and being clever, like having a piano on your head. Do you know what I mean? There was a cleverness to it that felt like something, you know?
It was a continuation of being alt in an adult sort of arena, I suppose. Like I had always, you know, I was nu metal, right, you know, and then I pivoted to this, you know, it was the perfect, it was a grown up way to be nu metal and still be like this, I'm different, I'm not a normie. But then it also had this additional, like, I'm really trying to rack my brain, like to put my finger on what it was for me, but it was just so, it had the same amount of like, yeah, duh, this is cool, that I used to have when I would wear baggy jeans and have a chain and, you know, like nu metal music. And then there was the hyper-sexed, you know, girls wearing like short skirts and smoking and like they were having sex and stuff like that. But I was like, there was this safety in my world of being like alt and also, like, psychologically, I was not ready to be grown up in those ways. And then, yeah, I just sort of continued it. I got my first boyfriend, I was like, you know, we got together because he sort of looked like Donnie Darko. And and we went to see, God, what did we go to see? You know, we would go to gigs and we were obsessed with Bright Eyes and he took me to Paris to see Bright Eyes for my birthday, right? And like everything was like handwritten notes, God. And we would take watercolors to Clumber Park and paint. And it was
God! Did you bring a typewriter wherever you went and did free poems for people?
It was one step away, to be honest. And yeah, and it was just so quirky and random, wasn't it? And like, but truly earnest and real in the moment, like obsessed. I don't know when it's shifted for me, but I remember the word twee started to be this thing that we had this manager. I spoke about a manager who'd got a band signed just before us. Massive record deal. They were called Tiny Dancers. Don't know if you, they had like a few hits and they,
I remember them. Yeah.
So Slow Club, like our first break was touring with Tiny Dancers, and Tiny Dancers used to have loads of balloons and confetti and they all dressed like really bonkers and it was super twee, but the music was really good and they were this hype band who got a big record deal. And to me, that was like, okay, everything's solved when you get the big record deal. That's all we can get. And this manager has got them that, so she can get us it. And like, obviously now that's not how it works. And, you know, it's a whole other podcast to talk about that time in the band, but like it wasn't a very nice relationship. And then it started to be this like twee, we kept getting called twee, and the manager really wanted to like dispel that. And how do we dispel that? Whilst also it was our intrinsically what we were, and we should have just leaned into it in the way that, you know, Noah and the Whale did and stuff like that, because we probably would have got a bit further. But we were just like stuck between, like, I would wear a dress and bake cakes that said Slow Club on and hand them out in the middle of the show, and people loved that, like, interactive, like, quirkiness. But then I was like deeply ashamed when we got called twee, and we were like, how do we stop being twee? So I have got this like mini theory about Slow Club and the sort of rise of Slow Club, which was like, I think there was too many opinions too early. And if we'd have just stuck to what we actually like, because we were twee bastards, we just were. Because that's what was cool. I'm sorry, it just was.
I've said this to you before, but, you know, again, you were at the top of the chute feeding stuff down and I was at the bottom of the chute receiving it. And I, you know, worked in HMV 2008 through 2011. And we felt like we invented it.
Yeah.
All of it. And that's the ego trip of being that kind of person, being in that sort of job. Like, I remember when, you know, one copy of Mumford and Sons came in and then we put it on the playlist, and then we thought we were the reason that people kept coming and asking for it. We thought we were the tastemakers of Cork City and therefore all of Ireland. Completely irrelevant to the, like, not tuned into the idea that other people were, you know, plugging this thing. We thought we invented. So all this music and Yeah So, which was the first Slow Club album, right? That came in and that became one of our playlist regulars. And I was obsessed with it. And I used to listen to it every morning when I was getting ready for college and stuff. And it's so weird having a relationship with you now because you were so present then. It's very odd. But I was walking around the park this morning, walking my dog, listening to the album again. And it's so funny because like your songwriting is solid. It's always going to be solid. It was always there. Obviously, you know that. But there's this sense when you have it in your headphones and you're looking out and the muddy park doesn't feel like the muddy park anymore. It feels like this sort of brisk vista where I could fall in love. Do you know what I mean? And like, my dog ran up to some random man who wasn't handsome and who I didn't like the look of, but for like a second, because you were in my ear with that sort of breathy romance of a 19-year-old, the world felt romantic and possible. And I was like, I get it. Like, this music, it works. It works on your heart, like, and your mind. When it works, it really works. When it's annoying, it's really annoying.
Exactly.
And that's why, you know, the movement folded in on itself so quickly, I think.
Exactly that. Like, I stand by all of it, apart from there's one that says, there's a song called When I Go, which is like fucking vomit inducing, but all the rest of them are. There's something, you know.
Unfortunately, it's the first track on the album.
Yeah. I'm like, ugh. But we did get that on I think it was a Lay's chips ad, which like paid our rent for like quite a few years, actually.
So wow.
All power to, you know, Justice for When I Go by Slow Club. But I see what you mean. And that's a lovely way to even think about it. And my relationship with it all is like I said earlier, like it's there's so many things at play that I still haven't worked through emotionally, and I can't see it with rose-tinted glasses yet, but I want to, and I think I will, because it was like innocent and real and probably like the most pure I could be in a way, because it didn't really. I had an excitement for writing songs that I, you know, still have, but it's been marred by having to write songs. You know, because it was that first album's like, we didn't need to. This wasn't We were both going to go to uni. I deferred for a year, and Charles was the year below me. So we had this like 1 year to do it or not, you know. And that absolutely changed the course of my whole life that we did do it. But yeah, we made that album in this studio in Sheffield that I don't even think is a studio anymore. And we had an engineer called Mike Tim, who was Richard Hawley's sound man. So he was just like absolutely brilliant at miking shit up. And we were so lucky to find that. And we produced it ourselves, you know. And no one was telling, you know, no like, you should work with this person, you should work with that person. We just were truly plugging away, trying to sound like Bright Eyes. And, you know, and also there's like moments of real, like it's this, when people talk about self-esteem lyrics, they're like, oh my God, you're so vulnerable and real and true. And I'm like, I've been saying this shit for over a decade. Like, go and listen to this Rebecca songs on this local album. Like, my heart's open then. You know, you just couldn't sort of, I don't know, people, you didn't notice. Or in a vintage dress and a ukulele, maybe you don't hear it as much. You just hear some of its parts. But yeah, funny old time though, that, like, yeah, never get it back. You know, that true innocence and true absolute 100%. I wouldn't want it to be anywhere else in the world than doing that, you know. Like, such focus on the goal of making real music, man.
Thank you. I'm interested in, because I imagine, because you toured so much and at quite a young age, and I'd love to know what the response was like on the road, because I'm sure you had, like, that thing of, like, handing out cakes at gigs is, you're right, that is like, if you were doing a parody of the time, you would have a musician do that in a movie, right? But it's also, it's true, and it's what you want to do when you're that age. You are just so thrilled that anyone would come at all, and it does feel like a party. And because, and I imagine, I'm putting myself in your shoes, because of this very sort of healthy online blogging sphere and MySpace sphere that was happening, probably you felt very connected to those fans, and therefore putting out food for your friends just feels like a normal and beautiful thing to do. But I'd be very interested to know, when you're supporting bigger, older bands, how they received you and their fans, yeah, and how they received you.
Well, yeah, just saying that, it's like, it's still in me now, and it's why self-esteem shows are like they are now. Like, I've always, like, if you're going to put me on a stage and there's lights, I always wanted to do something that you maybe not going to expect. It just doesn't make sense to me to not do that. So, and now it's like so ashamed. But at the time, this is how we grew bigger. This is how we got more gigs. I had a chair. You know about the chair? Did you ever see me play the chair?
No.
I had a chair, like, you know, with slats. And so I played the drums. So I had a kick drum, a snare, a tom, and then a chair on the back, and I used to go like with a drumstick on the back of that.
Beautiful stuff.
And everyone's like, whoa, man, she's playing a chair. And I would, honestly, my bollocks would be massive. I was like, yes, I'm David fucking Bowie right now. I am a genius. No one has ever thought to do this. And this is going to make you stop in your tracks and look. And so I always had that, like, desire to make you stop what you're doing and look up at what was happening. And I used to, oh my God, I had this thing that was a, like, a clothes rail, and with string, to like twine, song, bottles of Schlur, empty bottles of Schlur, which I filled up with different amounts of water with different coloured food colouring in. So they were all multicoloured rainbow.
Oh, my God.
And I would, like, plink, blank, plink, blank. Like, I made a makeshift Glockenspiel.
This is the thing about Twee, is that it's, you can make fun of it, but it's fucking charming.
It's
lovely. And I think so much of it was about, and I've been reading a lot about this morning. I read an entire, like, ebook on Twee in preparation for this, in which the life and death of Walt Disney are documented across a 40-page chapter. So it was quite an overwrought book. Like, it really went places.
Okay.
But it talks a lot about this sort of, like, post-Iraq war atmosphere where protest culture has failed, and the sort of you kind of have to admit that everything is owned by three companies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the urge to make something small and real when so much feels big and distant, I think it was a really real urge around that time. And I don't know.
Yeah, sorry, carry on. I'm just laughing at the slur because I left it in there and it went moldy. And then there's like mold in these bottles eventually, yeah. But I honestly, I was doing it from a place of where I'm still doing what, you know, that's why my shows now have like dance routines and we do all this shit in them and it's like theatre because everything is boring. So, I even had it then. If we're walking on stage, plonking the fucking bottles full of slur down in the chair, and I used to stand up and drum and in a dress. Like, I knew the power that had. Yeah. I mean... It looked bonkers, but it made people look. And it, and truly, which is, you know, we were a band because we kept getting tours. We never stopped touring because we were the perfect support band because we were just two people on the front of the stage, so easy to clear it off. And it was interesting. And yeah, to talk about post-Iraq and stuff like that, like it was so far from my brain space. But yeah, the trickle down, I guess, is there. And I just wanted to make, yeah, I just wanted it to feel, it's just really hard because right, like I could talk at length what I want to create right now. But back then I wonder what I thought because all I can remember thinking is I just want to be like, you know, the lead singer of Tilling in the Wall, and nothing was more powerful than to want to be cool. That's a shit answer, but it's the truth. I wish I could remember much more why we were doing it. But then also, like, slowly, it's just a cry for... It's a way to celebrate, like, altness. And I got to get my feelings out and have these, like, bonkers, quirky ideas. And not be like told to stop it or stop showing off and, you know, or told off. Like it was like school, just finished school, and then I could like do this mad shit if I want. Yeah, you know, it felt quite exciting. So
at what point in the sort of, you know, homemade Glockenspiel and all that kind of stuff, did the self-correcting instinct to not be that kick in? Did the stagecraft ever suffer as a result of that?
Yeah, like it, you know, so, well, not suffer. It's just the natural journey was we started to tour with other bands and we would see other, you know, Charles especially, I think, started to get a bit embarrassed by the flamboyant bits. I think he lost his sort of nerve a bit quicker than me in terms of like trying to be quirky or whatever. And there was nothing more powerful for me than to think, oh God, am I the loser, or I better change, you know? So, and I think we'd met other bands and we'd seen, I think it probably coincided with the sort of end of Twee being underground and cool and the start of it being on every advert and in the charts and Mumford and Sons and Now We're in the Whale and all that sort of thing. Probably around the time that it felt like Charles got really embarrassed by it all was probably around that time. And then I sort of agreed and became very ashamed as well. And then we just started to try and be like, you know, we got a drummer and a bassist and I just started to just play guitar and, you know, but it's the same thing applies to me. Like even now when I feel a little bit like on the back foot or I'm not sure, I'll do a gig in a t-shirt, you know, still.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'll tone it all down if I'm not at full capacity. And it was just a sort of, I entered into a good, you know, decade of not being sure of myself and suddenly like doing creative fun ideas and being different, quote unquote, like was too scary. So that was the death of it, really.
Did you ever feel like towards the end of that moment when you were starting to get more embarrassed and that being a reflection of like Charles's embarrassment, therefore becoming your embarrassment, was there ever a moment where you were interacting with your own audience and you would see, you know, I assume like probably girls like me, girls who were like 2 years younger than you wearing stuff you would have worn 3 years ago. Mm. And I think this happens to a lot of people where you become kind of, whether you like it or not, and whether it's a noble instinct or not, slightly repulsed by your own fan base. And you start to envy the Strokes' fan base or the Arctic Monkeys' fan base or something. Did that ever happen?
Absolutely. I just started to be like, damn it, I've put this rod for my back that I'm grossed out by and desperately embarrassed by. And yeah, me now, I'd be like, play to your fucking strengths, you stupid bitch. You know what I mean? Like, I can't believe I renounced it so quickly and so violently. But then I think it, if we could chart it, it probably went hand in hand with my like mental illness getting worse and me experiencing true depression and a true heartbreak and life just getting a bit fucking harder. And I got more nasty and dark-hearted and I just wanted to take the piss out of that girl who wasn't. Like, life just started to win a bit, like it does in your 20s, and you feel all this fucking shit and loads of this stuff happens to you. And I got very like, I hate myself, lol, fucking this, you know. That was my whole, as that part, that era of me started, it was. And I would blame how we set our stall out for what. Like, I have always had a fucking chip on my shoulder about, you know, Slow Club never reached the heights I wanted to, you know. And it's the perfect storm of reasons why, I think. And there's not one. It's multifactorial, absolutely. But I spent a lot of time really, yeah, thinking if we hadn't set it out like that, maybe it would be going better and maybe we'd be cooler. But what I actually should have done is just, you know, play to your strengths and do it and do what's good. But I also think, like, it's cool we transitioned and moved and changed. But I think it made for quite a confusing audience experience. And I don't think anyone quite understood what Slow Club were. Also because we weren't together or related. I think that always, like, made no sense to people. And so, yeah, I was really full of a lot of resentment. That I really pinned on the cakes, you know.
I think your journey mirrored the journey of sort of non-musicians.
Yeah.
The same thing of like, and I do, with that thing you were saying a minute ago about like Tilly and the Wall and like even Belle and Sebastian, like that kind of stuff. That stuff felt underground and intellectual, even though it celebrated naivety in youth. And it was quite precocious, all of it. And it sort of depended on you knowing a lot of references. And there was a coolness to that, right? But then, I think this was very much buttressed by the films. So I'm talking Juno, like 500 Days of Summer. Anything that had a pencil graphic as the poster. Oh. Do you know what I mean? Like, as in that sort of thing. Even Eternal Sunshine, which I think is a fucking masterpiece, it all contributed in its own way. And it became, and like Zooey Deschanel becomes the sort of poster girl of it. And, you know, suddenly you can buy vinyl in Urban Outfitters, which we can accept now. But at the time, I remember, was a real, you know, it felt like, oh, a sign of the times is that, you know, vinyl is now an accessory that you buy at a clothes shop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that all contributed towards this mass culture. And then all of us who had embraced all this American music, like Bright Eyes and all the stuff that we were getting on blogs and like going on Pitchfork to get, it all just felt like it lost its value. Because like I remember loving a band like the band Stars, and then that song, Your Ex-Lover Is Dead, being on Eternal Sunshine, and then suddenly, yeah, it's that age where you're constantly discarding things. And then it just got so big that it collapsed.
Yeah. I think it's, again, a few things ruined it, but what one was its early adapters went into the mid-20s, and I don't know anyone who gets through those years without getting pretty glass half empty for a bit, like, unless, like, I don't know, you're just really fine. I don't know anyone like that anyway. But it's it was truly like it was hard, but there's always been something I can connect with, especially with Bright Eyed. Like, even now, if I'm a bit like stuck to think or got no ideas of any songs or anything, like, I will put Bright Eyes back on because it's so wordy and there's so much going on and he's saying so much and it's all very, like, you know, if you disconnect from the sort of like tweeness or whatever, or the Americana-ness, or the like really over the topness, like, I'm still really into it. and it's still sort of it's still the blueprint for what I'm on about now, in a way, because he's really just being messy and real and yeah. So my shitty 20s really, I stayed connected to some of it, but then I couldn't like bear the sweetness or the carefreeness or the running through the park at night with a bottle of JD-ness of it anymore. It was like, but I think that's just because like my heart just got continually just fucking shat on and like life got in the way of my wide-eyedness. But it did make way for this, you know, it's still in there. It's still in there for me. Some twee shit is still in there. Lost Camper, like, still in there massively, you know. I just love it. It's great, you know. But it's funny, those things that the things that people really stuck onto, which was like xylophone, ukulele, going hey ho and all that sort of stuff, like, they're the things that still, so a song will fucking come out now and it'll be massive and I'll be like, for fuck's sake, Slow Club were doing that. We were doing that 15 years ago, and it's still, for some reason, to a mass market, I think it still reads as intellectual or alt or indie or cool to an enormous mass
intellectual
market,
while also being harmless. So you notice, like, if you're ever watching a short video or an advert by a very evil company, they will have background music about their ethos, about like, here's what we're doing to help protect your data, and it could sound like a Slow Club sound in the background.
Yeah, I fucking wish it was. Give me some. Get me paid.
Yeah. Give me the cash, Google.
Yes,
but the thing is that you talk about your sort of bittersweet relationship with this thing, and that's kind of why I'm interested in doing these episodes the most, is that, like, indie twee was a movement like any other. Like, it was like punk or like rap or whatever. It was a movement of young people who had come together to make music in their bedrooms and then show it to the world. Like, it's not different to any other musical movement. The only difference is because twee was so beloved by women and young girls, and so attached to a fashion culture as well, it's become more embarrassing. And I think, like, regardless of what music you were making back then, you would have gotten shit because you were a woman making music, you know?
Oh, God, yeah. But then I also think it's embarrassing. I'm just putting this together now, but, like, it's embarrassing because movements like punk and rap are born out of the sign of the times and the struggle of in that time, and a pushback or a need to communicate. Indie twee came from mostly just, like, pretty all right white people with not a lot of problems, ultimately, you know. And I think that's why it's embarrassing. My struggles were that, you know, you know, shitty boyfriends dumped me, you know, like that. I think that's why I'm humiliated by some of it, because it, as a movement of music, it was, it wasn't really rallying against anything.
Okay, but counterpoint. Yes, everything you said is true, but counterpoint. Like, There's no song on the Arctic Monkeys' first album that Slow Club couldn't have also written. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, I love that for you as an opinion, but
that's true.
Like, yeah. If you had come out with Mardi Bum,
yeah. Well, that's the
thing.
Do you
know what I mean? Something like Mardi Bum or whatever. Like, they were white kids who didn't have that many problems, and yet they retained their vision of cool.
Yes, yes. So let's think about that. you're totally right. But I think that's the other reason why it sort of becomes popular as well, because maybe life didn't always have to be rallying against something. And that's why Girls in Their Bedrooms really loved me, because I was just being very like them. And maybe it's the start of that closeness to something or resonating. I see what you mean about Arctic Monkeys, but I think that they... Well, I just think he's just so... fucking brilliant that they knew to evolve.
I think he's a fucking genius.
Yeah, me too. But I see what you mean. I bet like most people's first albums, they are like... I wonder if the Arctic Monkeys are like, oh God, I'm not playing Mardi Gras, I'm sorry. And I wonder if they have a similar connection to it. But I haven't really got a good answer. I'm trying to think like...
I bet Alex Turner is so jealous of you. Because... he still has to play I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor at gigs, and you don't have to play anything when from Yeso. You get to do what you want.
I do keep having this feeling like slowly really big famous people now and again are like self-esteem, or they've discovered it, and I'm like, you know, at an age where that's like nice, but it's, you know, it doesn't keep me up at night, I'm not like losing my shit, but it's nice, it's really nice, and I'm like, when is Alex... When's he going to email me? When? I'm here being so legit.
But yeah, I just assumed you were friends because you're both from Sheffield.
No, wow. I've got this feeling he'll meet me and be like, okay, there you were all along, love of my life. We can live in S11. Yeah, it's fine. It's the part of the journey, Caroline. I'm waiting. When he's ready, it'll happen.
When he's ready... The shadow of that man looms large over all of our lives, I think. Because I still... Because, like, you're talking and I'm like, no, he's in love with me.
Yeah, you know? All he has to do is meet you. It's fine. But no, they... Yeah. That's the thing with Slow Club, in a post-Arctic Monkeys world, for me, it felt like you could be from Sheffield and become the biggest band in the world. There was no reason not to be. It's possible. And that sort of really enabled this... The ambitious, big picture artist that I've ended up sort of only just being allowed to be. But that didn't really fit in a world of like plaid shirts and like, oh, we're just going to strum on this banjo and I'm not going to play it. I'm going to detune a banjo because, whoa, you know, and excuse me, sorry, don't mind me whilst I'm really talented, you know. That didn't really fit in. I did not fit in that world. But because I'm really like adaptable, and because I had formerly, you know, I had my end of high school journey with twee music and liking it and finding it really cool. I grabbed onto that, and that was a sort of mutual point to make music from. But then as soon as it was over for everyone, we were stuck with no uniting genre anymore. And that's why Slow Club sort of like, I'm proud of it all, but it was very hard to find a middle ground for us both to stick to want to sound like, which is why it's ended up sounding like Fleetwood Mac in the end, because it's like, okay, like, you know, Fleetwood Mac is forever, let's do that.
What a journey you've been on, man. What a journey we've all been on.
Yeah.
Just like a... representation of it. You're just the most fascinating person to talk to on this, because I feel like your music artistically has gone on the same journey that most of us mentally have gone on, and I think that's why everyone fucking loves you so much.
That is so fucking interesting, and we should do something more on it. Like, I am fascinated by it, that there is something weirder about self-esteem, certainly with women who are in and around the same age range. Like, I think there's so many levels to it. And I think the defining thing ultimately for women is the journey of like feminism and the penny dropping. Because the dresses and the shoop shoop.
Being bored of apologizing.
Yeah. The ukuleles, the dresses, the flowers, the all of that was just one more way to keep us, you know, second and submissive. But for me, I always think about, like, I was wearing the dresses and the flowers and the ballet flats, and I was singing a third above and singing shoop shoop and plinking and plonking the ukulele. But then I was drinking like 5 pints and puking and trying to have sex with every boy in a band I met. You know, it was like a real disconnect which then became, you know, thank God for like Winehouse and stuff. And we were like, oh, okay, you could be like, you can have this like indie aesthetic and also be like a fucking punk with your behavior and be whatever fuck you want. But like just before that, you know, we got, I don't know about you, but yeah, it was a real confusing time for my vibe.
This is quite a personal question and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. But I feel like as much as like twee indie culture was a thing, there was also the kind of twee indie dating culture. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where I think a mistake I made a lot when I was this age was I would gravitate towards boys who were also into Bright Eyes or also into, you know, Feist or Cat Power or whatever. And I would take that as recognition that they were good people.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would not be. I imagine if you're like dating the people who are also making that music, it's even.
Oh boy. Yeah.
You know, it's a quiet head fuck, I imagine. Like, because like, was the toxic masculinity that lived in those scenes any different to the toxic masculinity that was in any other kind of scene, do you think?
I think personally it was worse because it's stealth and undercover of this emotional intelligence or this being in touch with your feelings and the soft boy Instagram account, you know, like it, they're still alive and well, it's out there being, it's a red flag. I now see it as a red flag to be like into Bukowski and, you know, pressing flowers between pages. But at the time it was like very, it was like what you saw in movies. It was like, but it enabled a lot of boys to be really like, just, you know, be quiet or sort of ignore you or it's similar to, though, I don't know, like I've experienced men who have read a few feminism books now and really want to sort of pontificate about feminism, but then also not putting it into practice at all. And it's the same sort of thing. And I'm not like slagging everyone off, but it was a, you know, like, I'm only talking about men, and I hadn't like dated women till way after this era. So I was really like looking for a boyfriend who'd want to like marry me and have babies with me. Like I was still in that zone, but really wanted them to be alt and cool and like poetry and like movies and understand music and. And alongside that would have been like lads I went to school with who were like, I don't know, sporty and like go, you know, into coke and pints and banking. I don't know. Like at the same, like there was such a gulf for a bit where it was like normal lads or alt lads. And I was obsessed with alt lads. I wouldn't have gone near a normal lad. I don't know what I'm on about now, really. But like, yeah, it was, and the normal lads actually give you less bullshit than the guys that you sent very in connected to, because it all gives it, you know, often it just gives you an excuse or stealth, like a sort of you're undercover as a sexist pig, but with a fucking trilby on.
I feel like I'm doing these episodes to heal, really, but like it strikes me as so strange is that it was this era that like, and yes, part of it was that we were really young, and part of it is that it was culturally really unfashionable to talk about feminism or be interested in it at all. It strikes me as really weird that we were all like sitting on the floor listening to vinyls of Regina Spektor with the boys that we were kissing. but to ever say to him, you never, you know, let me, you're mean to me, for reasons that I think are based on my gender. And also I have to pay for my own cinema ticket. Like, on top of us both enjoying the work of Regina Spektor. Like, it's like, this is not, it's like this thing of like, just because we're intellectually and taste wise, we're aligned, he can't be a bad person.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. My God. Wild. I think they had it a confusing time too, because I don't know about you, but I was like, please, sir, open the door for me. You know, still, still fucking addled with that versus really far in the distance, say, the beginnings of my, like, I think, hang on a minute, that's not all right. Or I'm going to stand up for myself here, or whatever. You know, it was a long way off, but I think they did, it was like the last hurrah, certainly in my relationships with men, for, like, keeping me interested with the film camera, you know? It was the last time they got
with a Super 8 camera.
Yeah, that was the last hurrah, and I think maybe they low-key knew it and made them even more emotionally abusive. I don't know.
Because there's that thing. I know you have to go places, but like I rewatched 500 Days of Summer recently, and like that is such. Have you seen it?
Yes,
like lately?
Yeah. I think about it.
It's such a fucking baby incel movie.
Yes.
It's like this thing of like him refusing to take really no for an answer and refusing to listen to her at all. And him, like, you know, he works at a greeting card company, and there's this scene where he writes a thing that's like, roses are red, violets are blue, you're a whore. And then his which is like a funny joke, but his boss calls him up, and then he's all dejected, and he's like, so what, are you going to fire me? And his boss goes, no, Tom, you're one of the good ones. And I was like, fire him. Yeah. Like,
so I mean, and look,
like, it's so weird.
That is recent history. That is a movie you could still put on and sort of enjoy. But that was, this is what I mean. I mean, this is not the hottest take in the world to be like, movies really inform culture. But like, they really fucking do. I watched that and rooted for him just as much as anyone else. And then now I'm like, of course it's taking fucking ages to make slightly any change at all, because it's only just a minute ago that was absolutely fine and he was the hero. And she was the twat. And now I watch that going like, good,
she
like,
was
leave
twat.
Her alone. Yeah. It's applicable to loads.
She's been
of
very
really.
Clear.
Yeah. Imagine that. Just I do so many interviews and they're like, what's it like being a woman in music? And I'm like, it's the same as being a woman at all. Like, it's not fair and it's not as it's not as progressive as everyone thinks. And you have to have like a million, you know, very high intelligent concepts to back up your behaviour. Yeah, and things like 500 Days of Summer, or, you know, all those twee bands that's like call and response, boy, girl, and she has to harmonise, he gets the lead. It's just, you know, that's the trickle down from all that still. That was only recently. It's my hot take.
My last thing, because we've talked about music, we've talked about movies, we've talked about fashion, we've talked about dating. It's basically trying to deconstruct a whole subculture. My last thing is, I think, the vernacular, the slang, because there's no movement without slang. And I thought for a really long time today what the slang of twee was. And I think it was this kind of weird baby talk. Like saying things, and there's still evidence of it in our vernacular today of, I miss your face.
Oh my God.
And like,
oh my God, that's so true. Keep going.
You know, there was this whole thing about loving bacon for a while and just being really into ham. And it was like, this makes my mouth happy. And like something about, this makes my tummy happy. Like talking like a baby.
Yeah, nom, nom, nom.
While dressed like a librarian from the 60s. Yeah. Like nom, nom, nom. Exactly.
Fucking hell. That's so fucking funny. I want to think more on this, because you're right, there was, and it's not as, the slang was there, but I would have done it with all sincerity and, oh, I've got to think. But yeah, that, it is like, everything was childish though, weird. It was all, you know.
Yes.
All that like badges and nothing cooler than a hand-drawn artwork. Like, what, our second single, we had everybody draw pictures and we put them on the cover and it's like, it's just disgusting, like Crayola drawings.
I got thinking as well, the birthday present I got for everybody during one of those years was the indie rock coloring book. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
And it was all this stuff, all the hand-drawn art, all that. And I think part of it was because of the death of CD culture. People were trying to make more and more merch with very little resources in order to support the lack of CD sales. But I think there was also just this real protective instinct about the childlike mindset.
Mm. I want to talk to, you know, me and Gareth from Lost Camps just used to go out. Did you know that? He was a great boyfriend. He was a nice boyfriend. He's the best boyfriend, actually. When we were together, it was this sort of mutual hatred of what we were peddling, but also really believing in what we were peddling. It was a fucking weird mix of, I mean, we were both insane. But let me talk to him because I would love to know his take on this. Because I feel like I'm trying to answer your question and I'm thinking like, I want to know what Gareth thinks because I can't think what I think. It's a very indie mindset. What does a man think?
Deferring it to your boyfriend. My indie boyfriend.
Do you know what I still love and I still use? Like a group vocal that's off the mic. I still love that as a sonic texture. And that was born from Twee, so I'm grateful to that.
Things remain from Twee. I think sincerity. I think there's a lot of sincerity among people in their 30s. I think that's what results in the instinct of lots of people sharing very Twee infographics on Instagram about like...
Yeah, isn't it?
How many people are dead in a certain country or whatever. Yeah. And it's like, it's all the sunshine rainbows. And you're like, this is the hangover of Twee.
That is so true.
But yeah, it's like, you know, that meme that goes around every now and then of the goat saying, I am cringe, but I am free. Yeah. I think the same about Twee. I am Twee, but I am free.
I really love talking about it. My bestie Kelly, like some of her, you know, my piano in my hair was nothing compared to some of the mad shit she was putting on. So it's one of my favorite things to do is we send back and forth just pictures of us in those opaque tights. Aww. Man, like nothing quite like it.
Oh my god, the colored tights where we all look like we teach art for elves.
Yeah. It's fucking so gross. Oh man, it's been a pleasure though. I love it. Long live
it's been so good. I'll let you go. Rebecca Lucy Taylor, you are self-esteem. You are the most famous pop star in the world. I don't need to fucking say anything. But you've got a sold-out US and UK tour.
I do.
So
yeah,
people can not go to that if they don't have tickets. And
I'm doing every festival. I'm doing loads of festivals. Come and see.
Are you?
Festivals. Yeah.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.